Good afternoon, and welcome to our 15th annual Rosenkranz debate. I want to express our gratitude to the Rosenkranz Foundation for supporting this event for well over a decade. We love having this Saturday centerpiece for our convention, which is an intellectually sharp one-on-one debate between two highly prominent legal theorists. We've had quite a distinguished series, as those of you know who've been to a lot of these conferences. And without further ado, I want to turn it over to Nick Rosenkranz, professor of law at Georgetown, to moderate the debate. Nick?
Thanks. Thank you, Gene. Thanks, everybody. I'm delighted to be here. Gene and I had this idea to boost attendance and energy for the third day of the convention, and we seem to have succeeded in that. So thank you all for joining us on Saturday. Our resolution today is the U.S. Constitution limits the role of state courts and executives under Article 1, Section 4, Clause 1. And I'm just going to give you the text of the clause. The times, places, and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof. And so we're going to be debating the meaning of those words. This is my favorite kind of debate because it's, in a sense, like an intramural debate for us. More or less methodological agreement here, and yet substantive disagreement. Originalists, textualists don't always agree, and we're happy to showcase some civil debate and discussion about this question. So I'm going to be very brief introducing our debaters. You have much longer bios in the program. To my left is Akhil Reed Amar, Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale University. He's written many magnificent books. I'll just mention his most recent one, The Words That Made Us, America's Constitutional Conversation, 1760 to 1840, and I recommend it and all of his works very highly. I'll mention also that he's a great friend to the Federalist Society and a great friend to our Yale chapter, and we're always delighted when he comes down to join us at the convention. So we're thrilled that he's here today. I should also say, actually, that he's... I mentioned actually last time we were here that Akhil's also a great friend and mentor of mine, and I took 19 of my 53 credits at Yale with Akhil, which I think is some kind of record. I mentioned that last time we were here, and several people, you know, came up and asked me, well, why did you do that? But as I think back on my time at Yale Law School, I actually find myself wondering more and more, why did I take those other 34 credits with those other folks? So, but the classes I took with Akhil were fantastic and important to my legal education. To my right is Professor John Yu. He's the Emanuel S. Heller Professor of Law at Berkeley, also a senior fellow at AEI and visiting fellow at Hoover. He's also written many excellent books, and I'll mention his most recent. His 10th book is called Defender in Chief, Trump's Fight for Presidential Power, and it was published in 2020. And I should say, also, he is a great friend and mentor of mine at a an early time in my career. I went, and he was actually my boss at the Office of Legal Counsel, 2002 to 2004, and we worked very closely together on nothing in particular at all.
You forgot to say senator at the end.
So with that, I'm going to turn it over to our debaters. John is taking the pro side of our resolution, and our format will be 10 minutes each, 7 minutes each to reply, some moderated discussion, and then we'll have some questions from the audience. So, but without further ado, John Yu.
Thank you. Thanks, Nick, and thanks to the Federalist Society for inviting me to participate in this debate. It's intimidating for two reasons. One is I'm debating my teacher, Akhil Amar. He made many mistakes in his teaching of me in his classes, which I will reveal fully during this debate. But I said, in a mode of seriousness, Akhil is the one who taught me how to be an originalist back in the 80s, before it was cool. I had been an undergraduate at Harvard and majored in history. And let me tell you, being an Asian from Harvard, you had to be really good back then, right? I mean, my mom's still pissed about the personality score I got, let me tell you. Right? And so I got to Yale, and I saw, actually, I remember the first week I showed up at school, I got a flyer with, and I knew that was James Madison, actually, and I went to the first meetings, and I was hooked, and I started taking Akhil's classes. Like Nick, I think I took 19 units of Akhil for my 16 graded classes at Yale. I don't know how you had to be graded for 53 units a year. And then the other reason it's intimidating, this is the first Federal Society convention I've been to without my other mentor, Larry Silberman, around. I know you've heard testimonies from Justice Barrett and Ted Olson. So I just thought I'd share a little bit of the other side of Judge Silberman, the lighter side, because I think he would not have wanted to be remembered as just the litany of important jobs and famous clerks and so on, which is true. So I had a chance to do a little tribute to him at AEI over the summer, and I said, he gave me my first job. After law school, I went right away to clerk for him. Thank you, Akhil, for the letter of recommendation again. And so I remember calling home after my first week of being my first real paid 9-to-5 job. And they said, how do you like it? I was like, you know, Mom and Dad, this is really interesting. You didn't tell me this would happen. And they said, what? I didn't know there was so much cursing in the workplace. To which those of you know Silberman immediately responded, the only time I ever cursed was the year you clerked for me. It's a true story. And then the second thing he would say, because I would always, you know, as many of you may know, I don't know if the tribute said mentioned this, but he was the one in the Nixon administration who created the first affirmative action program, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. So he had always said, I still, when I clerked for him, he said, yeah, I still have affirmative action for Yale graduates. And then I think after we saw the video of the terrible free speech disruptions last year at Yale, I think he finally agreed affirmative action was a bad idea. So let me, in all seriousness then, turn to the subject of the debate. So as you know, we're really debating Moore versus Harper. We're really debating the an earlier case, the Arizona Independent Redistricting Commission case, which was a 5-to-4 decision with Justice Ginsburg writing in the majority and Chief Justice Roberts in dissent. And it's really a lot of the arguments that were presented in those opinions are reappearing now. I do have to compliment Akhil, who's written an amicus brief, and a lot of historians and so on have produced a lot more information and material than that was present and available at that time. Because I think if you go and read those opinions, I don't think the majority opinion is very strong. I think it's much stronger now, and this is a much closer question than I thought. If you want the other side, Sai Prakash and I wrote a piece together after that Arizona case came out. And the basic question, that's the first thing of mine Akhil has ever read in his life. Because I would say, you don't have to read my papers, just put double honors on it. It makes it all easier and faster. And in that paper, Sai and I argued that when the Constitution says state legislature, it means state legislature. It doesn't mean state. And that the Constitution carefully says sometimes state legislature, sometimes it says state executive, Sometimes in Article 6, it says state judges. And then sometimes, at other times, it says state. And we actually were taking seriously the arguments that Akhil made in this wonderful article called Intratextualism, where he said we should try, and this is, but as Akhil often does, he stole it all from Chief Justice Marshall, right, in McCullough versus Maryland, right? Every word in the Constitution has to be given a meaning. You can't render any word in the Constitution superfluous. And so if the Constitution says state legislature, it's using the word legislature for a reason. And you should not just elide it into the word state. Now, the majority's view in Arizona Redistricting Commission, and I believe this is basically the same view that Akhil takes, is that actually state legislature doesn't mean the body, the state legislature, which we are all accustomed and we all love so much, and which the founders were well familiar with, right? A multi-member elected body, right, that deliberates and votes, passes legislation. Justice Ginsburg, and I think Akhil take the view, actually that really means the highest power of the state, which is the people. And the people can, through their state constitutions, decide how to organize the legislative power any way they want. And so in Arizona redistricting, the court said, well, that means if the people acting through initiative want to transfer the power of redistricting to an independent commission, they can, because it's still the people who are really the legislature. And so we argued that doesn't make sense for a number of reasons. So if you try to take intertextualism seriously, try to give the word the same meaning everywhere, well, try putting that idea, it's the people of the state who decide, and insert it into every place in the Constitution that uses the word state legislature. Did the state constitutions allow either the people to wield that power, or did they allow the state constitutions to allow the executives and the judges, the courts of that state, to participate in that power? So what's the most obvious one at this time is senators. Right? State legislatures appointed the senators. Did governors veto senators when they were chosen by the state legislatures? Did state courts review the constitutionality, for whatever reason, under their own laws of who states picked as senators? Doesn't seem to be any record of that. Did states allow courts and executives to veto the ratification of constitutional amendments? That's another place where the Constitution says state legislatures approve constitutional amendments. It doesn't say states. Again, I don't think there's really any evidence or even really discussion at the time of the founding that this would be permissible. And then I think the reason why in Arizona redistricting, there might have been 5 amicus briefs, and now in this case, I think there's probably 50 amicus briefs, is because the obvious implications of this case are for presidential elector selection. Could a state legislature decide to cast it, to pick electors, irrespective of how state law ordered the selection of electors? And of course, this came up in 2020. It came up in 2000, very briefly. What if the state election laws didn't work? What if state election laws didn't yield a winner? Or what if the state legislature disagreed with the popular vote that had been rendered under state law? Could a state legislature choose to cast the elector votes for someone else? So do we have examples from the time of the founding around then of cases where governors vetoed a state legislature's selection of presidential electors, where state court, right, exercised judicial review under state law of the electors? I don't think there's really much, we couldn't find any evidence of this at the time of the founding. Part of that, of course, is because this is really a 20th century question. I mean, the real effort to change state government organization, change elections in this way, is really a product of like the late 19th and early 20th century. We didn't really see the founders thinking about it in these terms. So if you think the text and structure don't yield this kind of creative approach to reallocating power in the states to choose how to exercise the power of the legislatures under the Constitution, then does it come out of the history? And I think, you know, this is the, as Nick said, this is the kind of debate it's wonderful to have at the Federal Society, where we agree on the sources and even the order that you look at. We may disagree about the implications or the importance of various authorities. So again, I think Akhil's argument that's made in his brief, I should also have said Steve Calabresi is also co-signer of the brief, who's one of the founders of the Federal Society with us. He argues that of the states at the time of the founding, most of them did have the traditional governor, state legislature, state judiciary system, but that there were two states that were at odds. I think most know it was New York, which is a council of revision in which governors and judges participated. And so they say, aha, that's an example where it's not just pure state legislature, but actually the state is exercising its power in an unconventional way. It shows that you conservatives or you federalists should allow federalism to allow experimentation and was already taking place at the beginning. So isn't this the remedy for gross gerrymandering? Or
2 minutes.
Oh, sorry. You still, 30 years later, have the worst handwriting, Nick. He kept saying, don't write this memo, don't write this memo. I think he did.
So I don't know what you're talking about.
So I think what the arguments on the side of the North Carolina Supreme Court in this example, or on the Arizona independent redistricting case in the commission in the earlier example, is that if there's a problem with gerrymandering, if there's a problem that a state legislature would embed itself, use its power to keep itself, entrench itself in power, why couldn't an answer to that be, well, let the state constitutions be creative. Let them reorganize ways to fix that problem. If you go back and look at this, this is actually a problem the founders were worried about. James Madison actually, during the framing period, said one worry that the Federalists had was that the state legislatures would manipulate the election laws to allow themselves to control both the Senate appointments and the House. Anti-Federalists doubled down on this argument and said, you're creating a system which could actually allow the will of the people to be frustrated. I could be wrong, but when we looked at the history, I didn't see anybody respond on behalf of the Federalists. Oh, well, the answer is states are free to change their state constitutions in all kinds of unusual ways to get around entrenchment. Instead, and this is a structural point, they did have an answer. That's why, if you, as Nick read in the Elections Clause, Congress can overrule states in the time, places, and manner of elections. That was the escape valve. That's the remedy for extreme state legislative gerrymandering or abuse of the electoral process. And that's what the Federalists said when they were debating the Constitution. They did not, as far as I can tell, nobody represented to the people when they adopted the Constitution through state conventions that actually the solution to gerrymandering was allowing the states to radically change their constitutional systems. So in this case, I just conclude, because I'm at the end, is that I think one last way to think of this, and this is a challenge I'll put to him, is to Akhil, is because I love Akhil's work, and I agree with it most of the time. In this one case, I don't, and this is the Judge Silberman in me challenging you, because this is what he used to say to me all the time when I would make up some Yale stuff as a clerk, which he enjoyed. It was like he loved watching, like you would watch a sort of dog roll over and put your feet in the air and catch the ball. And he would always say, what's the limiting principle? Right? What is Akhil's limiting principle? If you were willing to say that a state can do anything to reallocate its powers, they can do anything to decide who's the state legislature for picking electors, picking senators, drawing districts, ratifying constitutional amendments, doesn't have to be a legislative body at all. Why not make it the CEO of Exxon? Right? Doesn't even have to be someone in this state government, does it? Is there any limit on how far state could? It could be Vladimir Putin. I didn't choose the head of Exxon and Vladimir Putin deliberately to take some kind of message. about fossil fuels, although that would increase my popularity rating in Berkeley from 2% to 7%. What is the limit on how far a state could go? Because as I read the arguments on the other side in favor of allowing anybody to use the state legislative power as long as it's right set out in the state constitution, you could, for example, in California, concentrate it all in Gavin Newsom. Or you could concentrate all in the Chief Justice of the state Supreme Court. There doesn't seem to be any check or any limiting principle on the argument for sort of this radical approach to state constitutions. Thanks.
Akhil Amar.
Such an honor to be with you all. Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm among friends here, and I've been so grateful for the friendship of the people in this room for many, many years. I'm your straight-talking friend, straight-shooting friend. And I tell my friends on the left that, for example, Roe is all made up. It's egregiously wrong. I've said that forever. And I'm pro-choice. And before Clarence Thomas said a word about it, or Antonin Scalia, or Sam Alito, or anyone on the modern court, I said there's a right to have a gun in the home for self-protection, and it's under not just the Second Amendment, but the Privileges or Immunities Clause, and I don't have a gun in my home. They scare me. So it's not my personal thing. I'm just not a gun guy. But that's actually what the Constitution says. And no Democrat, I'm a Democrat, no Democrat joined the Citizens United majority. And long before that case was decided, I said it's easy and obvious that people get to spend their money to promote their political causes, because duh. So I'm straight talking with my friends on the left, and I try to be straight talking with my friends on the right. I'm honored to be here. You might think this is actually a close question. It's not. It's not a remotely close question. And I don't say that about lots of other things. And I may not be able to persuade you in the 17 minutes allotted or even in the back and forth, because that's only 17 minutes, and I'm not nearly as smooth and as good-looking and as...
Don't say that stuff about Steve Calabresi.
I'm going to mention Steve in just a minute, you know, or as humorous as John. And so if you just, you know, base it on this conversation, you could maybe go wrong. So here's what I really want you to do. I want you all to read the amicus brief, because this is in writing. And it's unanswered and unanswerable, and he didn't give the answers to it. And I may not get to everything, and it'll take you half an hour. And it's only an amicus brief, but if you all read it, it's more likely that the clerks will read it, because this is an important networking organization. I know that will come as a shock to you. And the justices will read. And here's why this is better. Because my friend Steve Calabresi joined it. Okay? And it has his ideas too. And he does not speak for the Federalist Society in this brief. Okay? And he's so emphatic everywhere. I co-teach with him every year. And he's so emphatic that he does not speak for the society, but he has a connection to the society. And this is better than what I'm saying today, because it Steve's part of it. Oh, and there's this guy named Vic Amar who actually did a bunch of stuff too, and he's better too. So read the brief. Now I'm going to tell you, I think, what the main arguments are in the brief and why I actually don't think it's a close question the end. And I'll try to tell you what the limiting principle is and the right way to think about the case. And he famously said, that is President Clinton, then President Clinton, oh, it all depends on what the meaning of the word is, okay? Well, this one does, I think, I agree with my friend John, it comes down to what the meaning of the word legislature is. And there are two plausible interpretations, not one. And my view actually is the less plausible view to the ordinary person on the street who has given the thing 3 minutes worth of thought. But it's clearly the better view for anyone who's gone to law school and who has a brain. Clearly. That's a high bar, and I'm going to try to show it. Here's what ordinary people, if you go out and say, in Manhattan, you say, is Governor Hochul part of the legislature of New York? They say, what are you talking about? No, of course not. Governor not part of the legislature. Legislature meets over there. She lives, you know, in this different place. There's the legislature is the state assembly and state senate, and then there's the governor. Go, you ask just a person on the street, does Congress include the president? You say, no, what are you talking about? The Congress, they meet up on Capitol Hill over there, and it's the House and the Senate. And then the president, that's the executive branch, that's a different thing. And if you think it's an ordinary body, then you're going to think, actually, that here's the problem. You see, here's the problem. You're going to think, and he said it. He said, oh, do governors participate in the selection of senators before the 17th Amendment? They don't. It says legislature. You see, and governors were not part of picking senators pre-17th Amendment. And I'm saying, oh, but governors are part of the process of picking, legislating the rules for congressional selection or presidential selection. Oh my God, the head explodes. He's saying legislatures means one thing for Senate selection pre-17th Amendment and a different thing for congressional election and presidential election. Yes, it does. Oh, but the word has to mean the same thing in both places. No, it doesn't. The world's expert on this question, intertextualism, is now addressing you, and you have to read the intertextualism article in the Harvard Law Review, where I explain, you know, and Steve isn't there to correct me, and Vic isn't there to improve the prose, but sometimes words in the Constitution or phrases mean different things in different contexts. Are corporations persons within the meaning of the Constitution? Well, yes and no. Yes, when it comes to due process and just compensation. No, when it comes to one person, one vote. Because the last time I checked, corporations don't vote, you see, on election day, you know, yet. I know some of you want to change that, but okay. Congress, what does Congress mean? Sometimes in the Constitution, Congress means the House and Senate. The president shall give, from time to time, information on the State of the Union to Congress. And sometimes Congress means House and Senate and the president. The word Congress appears 60 times in the Constitution, and sometimes it means one thing, and sometimes it means the other. As when Congress decides to admit new states, from day one, that process has involved George freaking Washington and his successors. Congress, under Article 4, legislates for the territories. And it doesn't say Congress by law. And it's not in Article 1, which has the presentment clause. You see, it's Article 4. So, oh, context matters. So I'm saying sometimes legislature does mean this ordinary body, House, the Assembly and the Senate, and sometimes it means the lawmaking system of the jurisdiction. Just like Congress sometimes means House and Senate, and sometimes means House and Senate and President in a lawmaking system. Okay, so there are two definitions, actually, if you've gone to law school and have a brain for what legislature means. And one of them, and only one of them, is consistent with everything that we've done from day one and even day zero and day minus one. And I'm going to tell you what the originalist evidence shows on this. Legislature can mean a body, the state assembly, the state house, on its own, and that's how they pick senators and always have, or can mean the lawmaking system, the lawmaking power as defined by the parent constitution. Okay? Now, that's the choice. Here's the originalist evidence. on day one, in 11 states, you see, there's no difference between these two because there's no gubernatorial veto. And the world's expert on this is Steve Calabresi, my co-author, who actually theorizes the unitary executive, and he says, here's what's really interesting about the federal constitution. It has a presidency that has a veto power and other things that states don't have. That's what makes it so special. So in 11 states, these two definitions are the same, but they're two when they're not. Massachusetts has a governor with a veto pen, and so does New York as part of a council of revision. And you won't find that in Sai Prakash's and John Yoo's piece because they didn't know that, or if they did, they didn't put it in. And so I'm thinking, actually, since they're honest folks, they just didn't know that. He mentioned it, you know, earlier because I hope he's read the brief, and I hope you read the brief, because they didn't say that, you see, in the Arizona briefing, and that's why the court said, you know, the dissenter said some not so great things, and even the majority, because there wasn't good originalist briefing, because there weren't actually three originalist justices then that there are, you know, now, thanks to this society, or Steve would say members of this society, who, you know, have, so... Question in Massachusetts in 1789. Question in New York in 1789. Are we going to involve the governor when we actually legislate for the first Congress? Answer, yes and yes. They pick the second definition. It's the lawmaking system as defined by the state constitution, you see. And now, oh, the head's going to explode, but every state has a governor with a veto pen. And 11, you know, only two did before. So in 11 states, the governor actually, in every election, every year, everywhere, so far as I know, has been involved in the legislature picking the rules, defining the rules for congressional elections and presidential elections, even though they weren't in those states at the time of the founding. It's dynamic conformity rather than static conformity, if you're an Erie person. It's the state lawmaking system as defined and redefined by state constitutions over time. And states are allowed to change the rules. They're allowed to bring in a governor if they want, or to add an initiative and a referendum process, or to create an electoral commission, which in effect could be the legislature for that purpose. They're allowed to make their Supreme Court the Supreme Legislature, or their Supreme Legislature the Supreme Court, and Connecticut did that actually at the founding, and it could do so again. And the person who puts this in the brief is Steve Calabresi. The case is called Calder versus Bull. It's actually a pretty important case. This says states have very broad flexibility to define and redefine their systems of government, you see? And whether the state courts are elected indirectly or directly, whether there's separation of powers or not, these are decisions to be made by states about how they want to structure their systems. That's what the American Revolution was all about. The ability of states to actually decide how they wanted to be governed over time. That's a big structural idea. Okay, I'm gonna give you more, there's way more originalist evidence, and it's in the brief, I'm gonna give you just a little bit more, but he says, oh, well now, what's the limiting principle? Okay, so one thing he says is, oh, but that's different from picking senators, yes it is. And Congress sometimes means this, and sometimes means that. And so, this is the word person, and that's just true. I call it in intertextualism, chameleon words. And intertextualism is cited in the Arizona case, in the dissent by the chief, okay? And so, like, I'm thinking, this is the best of all possible worlds. The right side prevails, but I still get cited by the dissent. Good, okay. And John, there's just, so, that was a moderate laugh that I got. He gets big laughs, because he's very, so I can't believe that you got a low personality score at Harvard, okay? And I just have to tell you all, I haven't quite gotten over it. John.
I didn't get into Yale, Akhil. I only got into Harvard.
You're stealing my line. Hold on. I didn't get into Harvard. Okay. And I used to
think.
You
have a terrible personality.
Yes,
though,
this is the problem. That's why you have to read the brief. Don't judge me by my face here. You know, Lincoln, you know, was accused in the Lincoln-Douglas debates of being two-faced. He says, I leave it to you. If I had two faces, would I be wearing this one? Okay, so I used to think, you know, just, you know, I didn't deserve to get into Harvard. And only in the last year, thanks to affiliates in this room, I'm thinking, maybe there was some other reason I didn't get into Harvard, you know. So, what's the limiting principle, my friend asks? The limiting principle, as we explain in the brief, is the Republican Government Clause. So here's what they say. I want you to read their thing, because it's not persuasive. It's actually, there are parts of it, I'm being straight now, this was not your best work, John. It wasn't.
I wrote it with Psy.
And I love Psy, and I will support Psy. I can't tell you what my colleagues will do, but I will support Psy in every way. And Psy has one good passage in this. I know it's Psy's because it actually is honest, but it concedes the whole thing. And I'm going to read you the three passages. So here's page 356. I want you to read this thing. And I want you to read this thing, and there's no comparison. And in part because this thing was written after this one, so it knows stuff that this one didn't know. Okay, and there's tons of originalist evidence. I haven't even summarized it all. Here's what he says. The majority's reasoning runs directly counter to blah, blah, blah. It would permit a state to vest redistricting authority in a body that's unaccountable people, such as a judge with good behavior tenure, or a private party, or he says an emperor. No, you can't have an emperor because of the Republican Government Clause. It has to be Republican, but it could be directly or indirectly representative. You know, just like the Senate is not un-Republican. States had actually indirectly elected lawmakers. Calder versus Bull says you can give all legislative power to the Supreme Court or vice versa. Calder does say that, and thank you, Steve, for that point, which is central to the brief. That's the limiting principle. Why did they say legislature rather than state? Because here's now another passage. Oh, here's another passage. This is that I just gave you passage from page 357. Here's 355. Consider an absolute monarch with the power to make law. You know, and that would not be a legislature in 18th century sense. Yeah, it wouldn't be a Republican legislature because each state has to have a Republican form of government, and a monarch, which brings in ideas of heredity and all the rest, that just, you know, wouldn't be consistent with a Republican form of government.
2 minutes.
2 minutes, great. So that's one limiting principle. The additional key here is, and here's where Psy, and I think this is probably Psy, gives away the store. He said, gee, in the Arizona case, the court could have entertained the possibility that this commission was the legislature. Yeah, why not? You know, had the court been tempted to conclude that the commission was the legislature, it would have had to decide several issues. Among them would have been whether a legislature could consist of no more than 5 legislators. Okay, oh, so we have to, 5 is not good enough, but 50 is okay, and now we're going to have Justice Blackmun come up with trimesters in between. What are you talking about? Of course, they can give it to 5 or 50 or 500. That's up to them, not to 9 lawyers in Washington, D.C. That's a massive national power grab. That's Steve's phrase in the brief about how a state can choose to be governed. You know, none of whom was elected by people, well, they're indirectly elected, and the state gets to decide how much direct or indirection it's going to use. Now you say, oh, well, then why did they say legislature rather, you know, because that word you're actually giving no meaning to. Here's their other sentence. To begin, and justices have picked up on it, and it's wrong. And then I'm going to give you the more originalist evidence in the second round, because, oh, I got to save something for the second round. And give him an incentive to tell it to you first and somehow assume it away, because there's tons. To begin with, the court's reading effectively reads legislature out of the Elections Clause. It renders the word legislature superfluous. Ridiculous. Going forward, it is true that states have very broad definitions to redefine how they're going to structure legislative power. But they weren't worried about 2022 and 1787. They were worried about 1789. In 1789, legislature identified an existing institution, you know, that looked a certain way, and there wasn't, and they wanted the first elections to go off without a hitch, and they did because they're picking an existing institution. You say a word like state, well, who within the state, who's going to decide Who's going to decide who decides? Who's going to decide who decides who decides? Infinite regress problem. You're going to have all sorts of issues. Some states had legislatures do the appointing of state officials. Other states had executives do the appointing. Other states had judges doing the appointing. This solved the problem in 1789. It's going to cleanly jumpstart the system, and states are going to have broad power going forward to reshuffle things. It was sort of brilliant. It absolutely worked. And in 11 states, the issue doesn't arise, and here I'll end, because whether you think of it as House and Senate, a state assembly and Senate, or the lawmaking system, in 11 states, it's the same thing in 1789, okay? Because there is no gubernatorial veto, okay? It's only in 2 states where the issue arises. So you solve the problem of 11 states by just saying legislature. You raise a question in 2, and in both of those, Massachusetts and New York, they think about this question. They're not just looking at dictionaries. British dictionaries, English dictionaries that aren't based on American popular sovereignty theory aren't even going to answer that. But Johnson's dictionary does say the legislature can mean the legislative power of a jurisdiction. Both definitions are actually permissible and usable. But only 2 states actually have to think about it, and both of them in 1789 picked my understanding. Every state that adds governors since has used my understanding. Every state, for all elections, the Supreme Court in a case called Smiley pays a lot of attention to that. And there's one other big fact, which is in 10 of the first 10 states that actually thought about this question between the Articles of Confederation, 1777, and end of George Washington's administration, 1797, in every one of the 10 states that actually focused on this issue, the state constitution regulated the state legislature in all sorts of ways that are utterly inconsistent with my friend John's claim and with the petitioner's claim in ISL, in Moore versus Harper. I'll give you the details in round 2.
John, 7 minutes to reply, please.
Oh. I just have a few points. I take Akhil's point about maybe state legislature instead of state had a particular importance at the time of the founding in terms of setting the government up. But I think if you're a judge or a young lawyer, originalism is great. But I also think it makes sense to turn to originalism when you cannot get the answer from the text or the structure. I think we would all agree text and structure come first. And then you go to the historical context to almost in a way verify whether your reading of the text and structure makes sense. I still think, maybe I'm just not getting this. This does sound like one of his seminars. I'm not getting this, Akhil. But let's look at the text of the law. If you were to replace state legislature with just the word state in the elections clause, what difference would it make for Akhil's argument? Right? It would reach the exact same result, because his argument is that it's the sovereignty of the people that have the highest power. I agree with that. But then they are allowed to basically call anything they want the legislature. Second point he makes is, and if you believe otherwise, then you Federalists are being hypocrites. He didn't say hypocrites, but that's the implication. You're being hypocrites because generally Federalists favor federalism. Right. I remember, I didn't actually know that from the gala dinner that that's one of the reasons you chose Federalist. I just thought it was Federalist Papers. Steve was when I said, oh, it also because you like federalism. I didn't know that was part of the oath I was signing when I was 21. But I don't think you have to accept that implication, that if the Constitution's use of the phrase state legislature has to be given a single meaning roughly state legislatures as they exist in 1789, that freezes into place all state constitutional creativity. I think the way to think of it is that, and Madison did say this as well, is that the federal government relies on the states to be part of the federal government for certain functions. And I think this is one of them, where the federal constitution almost commandeers or drafts parts of the state government to perform federal functions. In this case, drawing congressional districts, which, again, I might add, under the Elections Clause, Congress could draw all the congressional districts in the country if it wanted to, if it wanted to override these state rules. That doesn't mean that states are forbidden from experimenting and changing the way they design and allocate state legislative power for everything else but those federal functions. I think it's only those federal functions, again, right, at the original, at the time of the founding, picking senators and then also picking electors, right, drawing districts, ratifying constitutional amendments. Right? In those few areas, the state legislature is kind of, right, dragooned into the service of the federal government. And then I think that's where the original understanding of what a state legislature was should inform how we understand the phrase. Akhil also talks about the changing understandings over time. This is my third point. But then why did our country pass the 17th Amendment? If Akhil is right that it was just up to state constitutions to decide how to define, allocate the state legislative power, then the states could have just individually changed all their state constitutions to say we're going to have popular election of senators. Chief Justice Roberts made that point in his dissent. Actually, you know, we've heard a lot about some of Chief Justice Roberts' greatest lines, like the way to get beyond discriminating by race is to stop discriminating against race, so on the basis of race. Actually, I think this is his best line. He said, you know, why did the people who wrote the 17th Amendment go through a constitutional amendment when they could have just done this, you know, change your own constitutions? And then this is the greatest line I ever heard Chief Justice Roberts write. He said, those chumps. third point, I quite take Akhil's point that you could understand state legislature in two ways. You could understand as referring to the institution of the legislature or the state lawmaking process, to just institution versus process. And I think, and this is where he really is a proud product of the Yale approach to constitutional law. This is, his argument is kind of like Alexander Bickel's argument against Brown. Right? You remember Alexander Bickel famously questioned Brown by looking at all the states that ratified the 14th Amendment and asking how many of them had segregated schools at the time. Notice Akhil's argument is, well, they ratified this language in the Elections Clause, and then how many of them had unorthodox approaches to state lawmaking? And he says there are two states, right? Two out of the 13. Well, 12, because I don't think we're counting Rhode Island, because there was some robber plantation at the time. We didn't let them into the Union. I thought we should never have reconsidered that decision, but we did. Sorry, Brian. So that's one, I think there's a very interesting methodological difference, because he would say, look at the practice of the state constitutions at the time. And I think we should do more of that, and we don't do enough of that when we do constitutional interpretation. But I also think there's another important source for originalism, which is look at what the Federalists said when they were engaged in debate with the Anti-Federalists. And if you can see certain points where Anti-Federalists criticized the system on these very grounds, what did the Federalists say in response, right? They had every incentive to interpret the Constitution, to get it through, to make the arguments that Akhil is making, right? As Akhil says, if anyone thought that the federal Constitution was gonna freeze, right, state constitutions and could never be changed, there would have been an uprising, another uprising. The thing I would say is this debate also at the time of the founding between Federalists and Anti-Federalists had to do with entrenched state elites using their own power over redistricting to control and perpetuate themselves in power. And the founders never responded that states could solve that problem by changing the definition of what a legislature was. Nobody made this argument, as far as I can tell, in the context of the specific debate about this provision, that actually state legislature means the highest lawmaking power of the state and however that lawmaking power chooses to reallocate institutions. Instead, they said the federal government can use its power in the Elections Clause to override any kind of state entrenchment of elites. So my last point is about Akhil's limiting principle. Because now, see, I hate to admit this to Akhil, but I have a very mischievous mind. And so in class, I used to think of all kinds of jokes while you were teaching, but I never said a single one of them. So, but I got to say, after hearing your limiting principle, that you have to be the Buzz Lightyear of Yale Law professors. Because you're limited, you know, as you remember, Buzz Lightyear, actually I'm probably getting this wrong, but isn't Buzz Lightyear's a slogan to infinity and beyond? So if your limiting principle is the Republican guarantee clause, isn't that the limiting principle is infinity and beyond? Because the Republican guarantee clause is no limit. Right? The court refuses to adjudicate it because it's too amorphous. Right? In fact, who does get to interpret the Republican guarantee clause? Congress. As far as I actually, I'm not sure in your list of Congress and the president, is it just Congress that gets to interpret the Republican guarantee clause? Or is it the Congress and the president get to reinterpret the guarantee clause? But I don't think that's much of a limiting principle. If it's a clause of the Constitution, which no court has enforced. Right? In fact, if there were a time to enforce it, would have been in the Pacific Telephone and Telegraph case when initiatives first started for the first time, and the court was presented with a challenge. Do initiatives violate the Republican form of guarantee clause? And the Supreme Court said, we're not going to adjudicate that. So I'm not convinced Republican guarantee is the limiting principle. And if it is, it would not have convinced Judge Silberman.
Just 7 minutes, Akhil, so we can save some time.
Great. And of course, the nice thing about what he just said about Judge Silberman is Judge Silberman isn't here to contradict him. You know? But I don't know about that, you know. So, because I think Judge Silberman got it right most of the time, and my friend John is not getting it right. So, he says, gee, it would be the exact same result if they said state versus legislature. No, I told you in 1789 there's a difference because state legislature means a certain fixed thing. Going forward, states can redefine things, but they cared about jumpstarting the system. That's a big difference. It's not true that every clause has to mean a lot of stuff. It just has to mean something, and I just explain why it's different. So what you said, that it would have no meaning, all the rest, is simply, what's the word I'm looking for? Wrong. Okay, done. Okay, that's one. Number two, I was a tough advisor, you know, when he was a student. The Constitution, he says, it designates state legislature for a certain function. It takes state legislatures as it finds them, and states are allowed to change. They're allowed to add gubernatorial vetoes if they want. And when they do, that's part of the lawmaking system. That's part of the legislature. It's not fixed in 1789. And to repeat, every state has done this in every election for over 150 years. And the Supreme Court focuses on this very fact and highlights it in a landmark unanimous case by a Chief Justice of the United States called Smiley versus Home, 1932. And here's what's really interesting about Smiley. It's authored by a Chief Justice who used to be the governor of New York, who actually pays attention to stuff like that gubernatorial veto pen. Okay? Now, the article, even before there was the Constitution, the Articles of Confederation had an almost identical provision for picking members of the Confederation Congress, and only three states adopt constitutions or amend them after 1777, and all three state constitutions tell state legislatures what to do. Viva voce voting versus ballot voting. You'll meet on this day. You'll do this thing. State constitutions tell state legislatures what to do under the identical words of the Articles of Confederation. And everyone knows that publicly when they draft the Constitution that simply repeats these words. Okay? State constitutions get to tell state legislatures what to do. And then under George Washington's tenure, another seven states actually adopt state constitutions that tell state legislatures what to do on congressional elections. Say, viva voce voting, or on this day, or you're going to do it actually unicamerally or bicamerally. You have to have free and fair elections, not just for state elections, but for federal elections, for all elections. Okay, and these free and fair election clauses, which are, that's the clause at issue in North Carolina. And here's what petitioners say. And they sound like John. Oh, how vague. You know, that was in 10 state constitutions, free and fair elections. just like everyone being born free and equal. That's the heart of the freaking American Revolution. Oh, how vague. Oh, all men are created equal. Oh, how vague. Oh, freedom of speech. Oh, how vague. You know, freedom of the press. The Republican government clause is the essence of the Constitution. And if you don't get that, then you shouldn't be Federalist Society members. And when he says, oh, a court hasn't interpreted, well, first, so much the worse for the court. And we are departmentalists. We actually think there's a constitution whether or not a court takes a clause seriously. And that's what I said 30 years ago about this thing called the Second Amendment, when no court had said anything on the topic. And that's what I said, and Steve said, about the Privileges or Immunity Clause. And Justice Scalia mocked that in the oral argument at City of Chicago versus McDonald, and he was wrong to do so. Because if it's in the Constitution, damn it, you take it seriously, and the Republican form of government clause is what we fought the American Revolution. That was what it's all about, for each state to be able to decide how it would be governed. And so it's embarrassing when you say, oh, that's meaningless because the Supreme Court hasn't glossed it or whatever. And that's not what we textualists, what we originalists believe, what we departmentalists believe, okay? And you say, oh, well, if this is so, if state is the same as legislature, why did we need the 17th Amendment? Well, there's a really interesting story about that. Couldn't states have on their own had direct election of senators? And in fact, they did. It's called the Oregon Plan. And the world's expert on all this is named Amar, but it's not Akil Amar. It's Vic Amar, and he's written articles on this, and you have to read them, and he's testified before the Congress on this. And the 17th Amendment actually means something different when it talks about legislature than actually Article 1 and Article 2, because this is intertextualism. Sometimes the same word means different things, because in the 17th Amendment, it talks about executives versus legislatures in the same sentence, and there's a lot of history about all that, but we're not Lincoln and Douglas here. But here's the point. Why was the Lincoln and Douglas debates, why did that have anything to do with the Senate election? Because that's pre-17th Amendment. You know, how are the people, you know, deciding, you know, who should be the senator of Illinois? They're deciding it because both political parties named their candidates in advance of the state legislative election. So if you wanted Lincoln, vote Republican. If you wanted a Douglas, vote Democrat. That was the first step toward actually direct popular election of senators. And then there were three intermediate steps. And here's what Oregon did. It's called the Oregon Plan. They actually said, well, we'll first have a beauty contest election. On the ballot, it'll say, do you prefer, in effect, Lincoln or Douglas? And it's not binding, but we'll just, you know, put it up to a straw vote. And then in round two, state legislatures on the election, there's their name, and their party, and whether they've pledged or not pledged, P or NP, to abide by the beauty contest. And then in the third round, actually, the state law actually purports to oblige them to pay attention to the Senate. So we had informal direct election of senators, actually, in a whole bunch of states before the 17th Amendment. And think about it, that has to be so. John Roberts, I love him, but he didn't know this stuff, okay? Because he can't be an expert on everything. But Vic Amar is an expert on this, and you have to read his stuff on this. He's my kid brother, but sometimes he's right on stuff, okay? Now, what was really, think about it. Why would US senators ever vote for a constitutional amendment that changes the rules about how US senators are selected? Because of course, whatever rules elected me have to be the greatest rules ever, right? Why would you ever vote by two-thirds vote to change? The answer is because actually pre-17th Amendment in many states there was de facto direct election. Partly because of one party rule in the South and the Midwest and a primary system, which is de facto direct election, and other places because of the Oregon Plan. So you should learn all about that stuff. And we have a whole discussion in our brief on the 17th Amendment, just like we have a whole discussion of the Republican Government Clause and Calder versus Bull. That's Steve's stuff, not mine. So finally, even if none of this was true, since we're talking about Moore versus Harper and not just this abstract issue, it makes no sense whatsoever to say that we're going to have different rules for federal elections than state elections. In state elections, for dog catcher, for city council, for state assemblyman and senator, state senator and governor, the state constitution governs all of that as construed by the state Supreme Court. And it will be preposterous to say, oh, but we're going to have totally different rules for congressional elections and presidential elections because state legislatures have chosen to have unified election systems. You vote in the same places on the same day with the same, you know, ballots and the same pencils and pens and voting machines and drop-off times and all the rest, and it will be utterly chaotic. It will make no sense at all to have a different regime. So even if somehow you think that you're with my friend John, that state constitutions can't regulate this stuff, state legislatures have in fact chosen, in effect, to incorporate by reference the state constitutional principles and the involvement of state courts in this process. They've chosen to do that even if it didn't bind them because they believe in their state constitutions. They don't go around saying, as petitioners do in Moore versus Harper, oh, free and fair elections, how vague, you know, somehow the American revolutionaries wanted free and fair elections for states, for state elections, but not for congressional elections or presidential elections. What sense would any of that make? Okay, so even if somehow you think that the state constitution doesn't apply of its own force and state courts can't be involved in their own force, they surely can be if invited by state legislatures, which they have been in every state in America today, including North Carolina.
Great, thank you, Gil. Now I'm gonna invite you both to speak in a less structured way to each other. I'm gonna ask a couple of questions and we'll take a couple of questions from the audience if we have time. So I take a
key. Those of you who are leaving, read him and Cy and read me and Steve and Vic. That's your assignment.
John, I take Akhil's point in a way to be that state legislatures are inherently creatures of state constitutions. We have to open a state constitution to figure out what the state legislature is. And once we've opened it to figure that out, aren't we also supposed to consult it to figure out what its rules might be and what its limits might be, even as to its exercise of federal functions? Is that, do you want to respond to that?
Oh, I was thinking, was there a question? One is, you achieve the same effect without using the word legislature. What if it just said state? Wouldn't you go through the exact process? If it said states, right, set the time, place, and manner of elections, including redistricting, you would go through the exact steps you just did. So why state legislatures? The second thing is, I think that the founders clearly had in mind some idea of what a state legislature looked like. And Akhil did say, you know, the limiting principle is a Republican guarantee clause. It has a definite meaning to him. Would a Republican guarantee clause be violated if, for example, they said, a state said, okay, under our state constitution, we are going to allow the time, place, and manner of elections to be set by a single individual. Right? Is a legislature got to be more than one person? Is that obvious from the Republican guarantee clause? What if the state constitution said we're going to give the power to a state Supreme Court? Or better yet, as in Moore versus Harper, suppose a state constitution doesn't say that the state Supreme Court can exercise that power, and instead it just takes it for itself. And as the state Supreme Court, they say we have the ultimate theory of power to interpret the state constitution, and we're going to set the redistricting maps in the state of North Carolina. Right? Well, those are all permissible unless you assume, I think that the framers, when they said state legislature, they had in mind, an outline which most people I think would agree on for what a legislature is, and it's not one person, and it's not courts.
Let's ask Akhil that question directly. So could it be delegated to a single person? How does your limiting principle actually apply, or can you flesh it out a bit more?
And Nick, I did like the question you asked him because it's so reminiscent, the first one, of John Marshall in Marbury. Like, if we're supposed to look at the Constitution, you know, why not look at the whole Constitution? If it's one person who's an emperor, that's going to be a problem because now there are no elections and that's not Republican. I'm just really not sure. Jury, I know what it means, and I'm with Justice Gorsuch. It means 12. how we want to structure lawmaking power, I don't think it necessarily has to be a multi-person thing. I think a state would be idiotic to try to give the power to one person. We might think that giving it to one person really does put at risk the system, because as a practical matter, when you give power to one person, that one person is going to say, let's call off the elections. Even if the government, the Constitution doesn't permit that, but once you've given all power to Donald Trump, to one person, as a practical matter, that's going to put and which is why I think the people would, of course, never do that. And I'm looking at my friend Steve Calabresi because I'm so very proud of him, and he did not speak for the Federalist Society when he said this, but he writes an op-ed when Donald Trump is proposing postponing presidential elections in June and July of 2012. He writes an op-ed saying if he persists in that, he should be impeached, okay? Because Abraham Lincoln holds election fair and square in the middle of a civil war on time. So as a practical matter, I think one person would actually risk the idea of ending a republic, which involves, you know, routine elections. And the like.
And therefore it would be unconstitutional.
I think so.
So I look
forward. But as a practical matter, if the people themselves, but here's what they surely can do. They can have legislation by town meeting, and New England does have that at the founding. It can have today initiatives and referenda. John lives in, you know, the People's Republic of California, where, you know, we do. And who's the one Republican appointee who really gets it in Arizona? He's a Californian named Anthony Kennedy, in part because we do have kind of direct lawmaking systems, different systems of legislation, especially in the West. At the time of the Constitution, Calder versus Bull, I'm looking at my friend Steve, state Supreme Courts and state legislatures were one and the same in Connecticut. The legislature was the Supreme Court and vice versa. That's in 1789.
Now let me ask both of you Gene Meyer's question. I think it's the question that many of us have, actually. So I maybe should have done this at the beginning just to lay out the facts a bit of the case. So the North Carolina legislature drew its map, and the North Carolina court said, this map is inconsistent with the Fair Elections Clause of the North Carolina Constitution. The state legislature went back and drew a new map, and the court said, this map also is not okay, and therefore we're gonna use our map that we've adopted, the court's map. Now, can't I, Akhil, grant you much of your argument, grant you, for example, that state governors are meant to be involved in the process and can veto these things, and yet still think that that's not okay?
You might, but it's ultimately a question of North Carolina constitutional law. And here's what I want to say, that I never took the North Carolina bar, and in fact, I never took any bar. And by the way, neither did Steve Calabresi, and he does not speak for the entire Federalist Society. Okay. And I'm not sure if any of the justices of the US Supreme Court ever took the North Carolina bar. So far as I am aware, none of them may have ever set foot in the state of North Carolina. So it's not their call. And he asked, well, what happens when the North Carolina Constitution, court uses some very vague provision? Oh, how vague. This goes back to 1776. And it's readopted after the Constitution in the new North Carolina Constitution. That's one of the 10 that I actually mentioned to you early on. This is Caleb Nelson, this is Will Bode, this is liquidation, clarification, gloss, this is the Federalist 37 at the founding. But if they misbehave, it's ultimately a question of their misinterpretation of an important clause in the state constitution that goes all the way back to 1776, and then they can be impeached in North Carolina by North Carolinians. They can be voted out of office in North Carolina by North Carolinians. As a matter of departmentalism, there can be all sorts of pushback from the North Carolina legislature, which is red, and the North Carolina governor. So that's actually, it should be ultimately, because I'm not an expert on North Carolina state constitutional law. And with all due respect, Your Honors, may it please the court, you know, your highnesses, that's you aren't either. And actually, neither is my friend John Yoo. This is ultimately a question of North Carolina constitutional law, which under Erie and Federalism 101 is to be decided by the North Carolina Supreme Court. And if they get it wrong, there are North Carolina state constitutional remedies for that.
John, would you like to speak to either the possibility of some sort of middle position or anything else that Akhil just said or anything else?
Well, if Akhil is against all power being concentrated in a single individual for unlimited amounts of time, I look forward to his many amicus briefs in every COVID case in every state court in the country against every governor in the union, right? Because that is going on in every state. Mm-hmm. I didn't see anybody raising Republican guarantee clause arguments against what's been going on, but the governor of California actually exercises the police power of the state during the COVID emergency, which is up to him to decide when it started and when it ended. So, I mean, I assume that your vision of state constitution would allow that. As long as he's not an emperor, we just call him an elected governor who just gets reelected every 4 years.
So
right?
two things on that, since we're really debating and talking as friends. So one, that's there are remedies within each state to impeach Gavin Newsom or anything else and recall him. And two, you're good at this and I'm not. This is why I want you to read. But I understand when you go on Fox, my friend, that COVID, is like, the go-to, response when you don't have a good answer to the question, okay? But not here.
I've never been on Hannity, okay?
But I'm saying I don't have a COVID position. I didn't file a brief on that because I actually am not expert on the laws of each of the states. What I am saying is there are state remedies when judges get too big, governors too big for their britches.
So I think this is where the state law point, where you and I differ, because it seems to me that there has to be some limit in the way the state law controls a state legislature when it's performing a federal function. Mm. So let me give you a hypothetical. Suppose a North Carolina Supreme Court doesn't like the outcome of the popular election for president. Suppose a state Supreme Court in North Carolina orders the legislature to select electors to the presidency for the other candidate who lost the popular election. Do we say, we really don't know how state law operates. Maybe the state court does have that power to command the state legislature to cast electoral votes one way or the other. Actually, as a side, I think this was the position that Vice President Gore took in Bush versus Gore and was rejected by the Supreme Court. There are certain times when state institutions, when they perform federal functions, I think they're being governed by federal law. Actually, you were the one who brought this point to my mind as a young kid. You were saying that when state courts, if there were no federal courts, state courts are the lower federal courts, but they're performing federal functions and are bound by federal law when they do that. So it doesn't seem to me obvious that state legislatures, they're performing a federal function, but then there's this kind of unlimited power.
So here's my limit on that.
Control what they do.
And here's why Nick's first question was so good, because Nick was channeling John Marshall in Marbury when he says, well, if you look at the Constitution, we have to be able to look at the whole thing. And people who don't believe in judicial review, the Brutuses of the world, say, well, then you can do anything, at all. And in principle, there's got to be the last word sort of somewhere, and it's always going to be capable of abuse of a certain sort. Now, my view is the US Supreme Court can properly review, and this is also, we actually have a discussion of this in the brief, can review the state Supreme Court, but here's the review question. Are they doing something in the name of interpreting that is so out of sync with what they've ever done before, with what actually the pre-existing legal materials permit, that they're just not acting lawfully? It's a due process, and you say, oh, how vague. Rule of law, oh, how vague. These are important. Republican government, okay, that's, and here's a more concrete way of putting it. The US Supreme Court should overturn them if, but only if, it would do the same thing if the state Supreme Court were doing this about a state election. for dog catcher, for city council, for governor or mayor or state legislature. That's the test, you know. But in North Carolina, you know, when North Carolina judges misbehave, we have, or North Carolina governors in COVID. I honestly don't have a position on COVID. I really don't. So it's not my go-to red meat thing in general. But that's actually, it's a rule of law test. They are performing a federal function, and if they're doing something really different from federal elections, for example, than they do for state elections, I'm going to be very suspicious if I'm a U.S. Supreme Court justice. But otherwise, they get to decide, because they are the definitive interpreters of the meaning of state constitutions.
Let's take a few questions from the audience, please, sir.
Hi, Greg Dolan from the University of Baltimore. And I want to push Professor Yu on this question of limiting principle. State structures themselves differently. There's two states that have, for example, two Supreme Courts, right? Texas and Oklahoma, they have the Civil Supreme Court and a Court of Criminal Appeals. So imagine a world where, say, Texas has to have two legislatures. One just does taxes and, I don't know, licensing, and the other one does everything else. What would be the legislature? And if that's okay, why can't we have two legislatures? One does everything else, and the other one does election law. And we'll call that legislature Independent Redistricting Commission, right? It's not one guy, it's not an emperor. Would that be a problem? And so what's your limiting principle? Say, like, legislature has to actually mean, you know, two houses, et cetera, et cetera.
So. Good.
You know, I think that's a good question because I guess ultimately I hadn't thought it through, but it seems to me the federal system already accepts that, as you say, Texas has two high courts, one for different subjects. We don't consider that undermining Article 6 and the Supremacy Clause and the idea of, right, state courts, which are explicitly discussed, being able to be part of the federal system. So I guess I'd have to accept that could be true of legislative functions too. It's certainly true of executive functions. I actually didn't mention this, but one point I wanted to ask Akhil was, if he believed his argument, then you also must accept that a state could redefine who's the executive and the judiciary for purposes of playing federal functions too. And the Constitution does talk about state executives as distinct from states. And as we know, some states, Akhil's very cruel because he keeps reminding me I live in California. But in California, we have, I think, 6 statewide elected executives now. I'm not sure whether for federal purposes, which one is the executive for performing federal functions. That's your question, right? So if you have multiple legislatures, how does the federal government identify which of the legislatures is the one to perform the federal function? And maybe you're right, maybe it's just the state designates,
right,
which one of the 5 legislatures it's gonna create is responsible. I guess, for example, I know state did this. I don't even know if this is a Republican form of government, but suppose a state just split itself up into 5 regions and each one had a legislature. Which one of those would actually be the one in charge of casting the electoral vote or picking the senators? So I guess it would be up to the state to designate which one. But I still think there's a limit into what kind of body it would be. And that we take from the original understanding of what the founders thought a legislature was. So I resist the idea that it would be one person, and I resist the idea it would be a court, which I think Akhil accepts that it could be one person. It doesn't have to be an emperor, so it's just the governor. Or your point, a special person just elected to do the redistricting. The problem was that in the Arizona case, Arizona did not claim that the redistricting commission was actually a legislature. They just said, under state law, we're allowed to delegate these functions outside the legislature to a body, and that's not really reviewable by the Supreme Court.
Let's take a question over here.
Yeah. Just on that very quickly, our brief makes your point, and we agree with you at page 23, and Cy and John's article discusses this but gives up everything at 2 pages in, at page 355, 356 of their piece, and also at page 363, 364.
Sure.
Just make sure you download it off of SSRN.
Yes.
When you look these sites
up.
So
I'm somewhat afraid my question has already been answered, but the Constitution does refer to the legislative power, the judicial power and the executive power, suggesting that Congress and the people who adopted the Constitution had definite ideas about what those things were. So if they're referring to the legislature, aren't they referring to something that has a legislative power? And more to the point, the thing that I'm not sure has been answered yet, what was that idea that they had of what legislative power was?
Power to make rules, basically. And Steve would want me to make sure, because this was his important contribution to the brief, that separation of power system is not being imposed on states. And in fact, at the time of the Constitution, many of the states did not have a highly articulated separation of power system. To repeat, in Connecticut and in other states, modeled on the British House of Lords, the state Supreme Court, the state legislature, or the upper house of it was actually the state Supreme Court, for example. They weren't separate governor's vetoes in 11 of the states, and appointments are being made directly by lawmakers and not executives. So this highly articulated separation of power system is a federal thing, but not imposed on the state constitutions, on the states.
Sir.
Right. I was with John until he said that stuff about Rhode Island. But John, didn't the court somewhat enforce, after fashion, the Republican Guarantee Clause in Reynolds v. Sims? And Akhil and Steve, aren't you with Harlan and myself a bit, at least metaphorically, unless you considered Swamp Yankees to be a caste, perhaps, and that elevating their voting abilities versus other citizens in the state would be a caste system?
On the Republican Government Clause more generally, since I'm giving you all sorts of reading assignments, my recommendation would be an article in 1994 Colorado Law Review called The Central Meaning of Republican Government. Majority rule, popular sovereignty, majority rule, and the denominator problem. It's by yours truly.
Okay. I think when I was citing the court's treatment of Republican Guarantee, it was to show how difficult it was to actually give it content. And even in cases like Reynolds and other cases, the court has not been able to establish lines about what is and what's not a Republican Guarantee. This is more like the second part of the political question doctrine, not the first part where it's a question textually committed. It's just something that doesn't have judicially manageable standards to it. And if it's hard for the courts to do it, then right, I'm just saying, how is it that that's going to be enforceable? Because I took that to be Akhil's argument, that this would be the limiting principle, and it would be enforced at least by federal courts to prevent some kind of excessive version of reallocation, redesign of state government beyond some limit, which is not clear from the text of the Republican Guarantee Clause, which states cannot go.
And here's where we agree. You say Congress is important in Article 1, maybe not so much in Article 2. I agree. The Republican Government Clause is one of the most important clauses in the history of America because it is the sleeping giant that awakens during Reconstruction, and Congress enforces it as the absolute foundation of the process by which the 14th Amendment becomes the law of our land. My friend Randy Barnett is there. He's written co-authored an important book on the 14th Amendment. And those of us who study the 14th Amendment understand that this clause that didn't get a lot of attention because of slavery and other things at the founding reawakened. It was, in Charles Sumner's phrase, the sleeping giant of the Constitution that is absolutely central to Reconstruction. And it means something, and Congress is enforcing it. And John actually, in his more deliberate moments, recognizes that even if something isn't enforced by courts, it's in the Constitution and important, and he believes that Congress actually has a role. So this is actually a possible common ground between the two of us.
Yeah, and in fact, just one more thing on this is, my argument is that the Elections Clause already has that contained within it, because Congress, if it doesn't think a state is doing this properly, they can pass a federal law to override state time, place, and manner restrictions on voting.
Sir.
Hi, I'm going to channel John Marshall, or John, if that's okay. But we've talked a lot about governors and the power. I wonder if you could speak to the argument that's out there, if this theory is adopted, that courts can't use their power of judicial review to review these laws. And if there's if those arguments are just, you know, scaremongery, or if there's actually something to that. Since judicial review is something that's been around even before Marbury v. Madison. So thank you.
I think actually Akhil and I both agree that judicial review actually is in the Constitution.
And in the briefs, in general,
which
not
you should
mine,
all read.
No, but the, many of the other briefs, an outstanding article, because this one isn't so good, but an outstanding article by Prakash and you is cited in many of the briefs, the other amicus briefs, an outstanding piece that they wrote on the history of judicial review pre-Marbury at the state level. I really commend it to you. I cite it myself. You know, that's one of their best. Now, since Steve is here, he wrote a book on the unitary executive with Christopher Yu. And I was going to blurb it, and this was what I was going to say. No, not that Calabresi, Guido. No, not that you, John, you, better. But Prakash and you on the history of judicial review is an outstanding piece that I commend to you all.
Unlike Vic, Christopher is no relation, so I'm not going to plug his work.
And you did get cited in a ton of briefs on this.
Did we?
Yeah.
That's so kind.
Yes. My name is Briard. I'm leading the Paris chapter. In case you don't know, the Federalist Society has a French connection. Thank you. Thanks to the Federalist Society for welcoming us. And this is our year 17. We come here since 2005. My remark is about the word legislature, and as French citizens, French lawyers, we are very interested in your debate. I'd like to remind you of one thing. The framers of that clause, the election clause, had a favorite book, and that book was not an Italian one or Spanish or British. It was not British for sure. it was a French book. The French book was L'Esprit des Lois, the spirit of the laws, right? And to us, when we read L'Esprit des Lois, our understanding of legislature is very clearly that Montesquieu was thinking of the body itself. The institution, not the law-making process, the institution itself. And by nature, for Montesquieu, that body was independent. So I wish Montesquieu would be with us today, because he would say yes to the independent state legislature theory. Thank you.
Montesquieu is cited by the Federalists in the debates more than any other authority. Blackstone and Locke are tied for second, according to the work of Donald Lutz. But of course, it's utterly clear in the Constitution that Congress sometimes means the lawmaking an institution and sometimes means the legislative power. Montesquieu, of course, with all due respect, is a French person commenting on the British Constitution, which is very different than the American system. So if we're proper originalists, we need to understand candidly what the Americans understand themselves to be doing in the moment. And they have an Articles of Confederation where state constitutions are treating legislatures as not independent. And then they do the same thing immediately after the US Constitution. And if we're doing proper American originalism, that's so much more dispositive than, with all due respect, you know, a French person talking about the British Constitution.
I share Keel's view on French writers.
We could obviously go for hours on this, but I'm getting the signal that we are out of time. Please thank our debaters.